47 years of tree sales. Have you calculated? Do you have a rough estimate of how many trees you've sold over the years?
I think I'm running around 188,000
Wow.
at the moment.
Okay, that's pretty cool. That's a lot of trees moved through your hands and out there planted in the world.
Yes, indeed. And my hands have touched hundreds of thousands of additional ones, but maybe I'll have time to mention that later.
Okay, cool. Sounds good. All right, I'm going to start our intro here. Hello and welcome to the Starting and Operating a Successful Permaculture Nursery Summit brought to you by the Permaculture Institute of North America, or PINA. If you support permaculture across the North American continent, then please consider becoming a PINA member today at pina.in. Today's summit is brought to you by PINA members and for PINA members and the greater permaculture community. I'm Jesse. I'll be your host for today's summit. And our next presenter is the resplendent Michael Pilarski, or Skeeter, presenting on the topic of 47 years of permaculture traveling tree sales. Cool. Skeeter is the founder of Friends of the, excuse me, Skeeter is the founder of Friends of the Trees Botanicals and has spent over 25 years cultivating and wildcrafting over 150 species of botanicals on his half-acre herb farm at Finn River Farm and Cidery in Shinmakam, Washington. I don't know if I pronounced that right.
Chimacum.
Chimacum. The farm employs a complex agroforestry system integrating medicinal herbs, trees, shrubs, vegetables, culinary herbs, and even weeds like dandelions, which are harvested as crops. Committed to sustainable practices, Skeeter incorporates permaculture and restorative land techniques to maintain a healthy ecosystem and strong plant yields. Beginning his farming journey at a young age, Skeeter founded the Friends of the Trees Society in 1978 and completed his first permaculture design course in 1982. Over the years, he has taught 36 permaculture design courses internationally and gained expertise in agroforestry, medicinal herb growing, tree planting, ethnobotany, and wildcrafting. Skeeter's work is driven by a lifelong passion for plants and earth repair, and he is dedicated to teaching others sustainable farming practices while fostering a deeper connection with the land. Welcome, Skeeter. It's great to have you.
Yeah, great to be here. And I see there's a fair amount of friends out there whose names I see, so it's nice. It's always great to see friends. It brings that warm, fuzzy feeling.
That's right, exactly. Even if it's just over Zoom, it's better than nothing, but we hope we can get together in person, maybe at a convergence coming up or something like that. Hey, Skeeter, I've been asking everybody the same question just to start with. What impact has permaculture had on your life?
Well, it changed my life forever when I took my first course. And I say that, especially for in-person courses, that your first course should change the course of your life. You should never be the same if it's a good course. If it didn't do that, it wasn't a good course, I guess. But and so I've been using permaculture ever since I learned about it. So I first heard about it in 1980 or 81. I was already writing publications about permaculture, just short little things locally, before I ever took a course. But I just knew that I was jumping on that bandwagon. And when I took my first course in 82, and I actually got to meet Bill Mollison at that course, I've been a proponent of permaculture ever since. And I do believe that of all the different restoration disciplines and regenerative agriculture disciplines, et cetera, out in the world, that permaculture actually, I really do think it has the best handle on designing really good systems that'll be good for the earth and good for the people. That we don't take a backseat to anyone in that sense. And I will just point out that I've been with a fair amount of people in Africa lately on Zoom, and invariably, almost everybody that's on our calls from Africa says that they are into permaculture and they love permaculture. Anyway.
Awesome. That's so great to hear because you mo probably more than most know about pretty much all the restorative land-based repair practices that are out there. So that's really cool to hear. I as a permaculturist, love to bring them all in and use them when appropriate in our design. And that's one of the things I love about permaculture. It's like the open toolbox. We'll take all the good tools and we'll use them when appropriate. So that's great. What about switching gears a little bit? Why selling trees or why like a nursery? What is it about that that's kept you involved in it for so long? And what is it about that field that you might suggest others are worthy to walk in those footsteps?
Well, I was inspired by Richard St. Barbe Baker in 1978 to start Friends of the Tree Society with the goal to double the world's forest cover. And so I've been on that path ever since. And so trees has always been part of my big love. But today, what I would say to people is that we know that to fix the world's climate and to cool our overheating at the moment, that we can do that by greening up the planet. We need to approximately 50% of the planet's land surface does not have adequate plant cover at this time. And it's humanity's, the solution is staring us in the face. It is to green up more and more of that area that's not green enough. And so we need a lot of nurseries to do that. We actually need thousands and probably you might say millions at the small scale of nurseries all around the world. Every area that needs restoration in Kenya or in the Midwest or here in Washington, it all needs nurseries. And so we need, unfortunately, the world doesn't recognize that it needs this yet, a lot of it. And so the demand does not equate to the need. Right now, the need is great, and but the demand, the market share. It's interesting. Ken Asma said that the market is really competitive to be in the nursery business, and there's a lot of nurseries out there. But he, as he said, specialize, and is one of the tracks to success. So. In a sense, we could say that doing nurseries is also emergency preparedness. I see a time coming when there's going to be a collapse of the supply chains, et cetera, and every area will be more thrown on its local resources for food. And so local nurseries for all kinds of food crops will be right now. Oh, we get our order from the other side of the country in our email box, and then we send it off on UPS. But if that starts breaking down, there'll need to be the local nurseries that supply the local people. So anybody that has those little nurseries started at any rate, they can ramp them up as needed. So we need, there's sort of our prep strategy is to have small nurseries out there.
Beautiful. I love that you brought that in. Hey, just as a video guy, I'm hearing the clicking of the pen. Do you
Oh.
mind? Yep, because
Oh
that'll
yeah,
bother me later.
I have to sit on my hands during these events, but maybe I'll try that.
You just need a
But
pencil. That's all.
you just
No.
holler.
Yeah. No, it's all good. Thank you so much, Peter, and I'll or Peter, Skeeter, and I'll let you get off onto your presentation, which I gather you're just going to sort of talk from the heart. You might have a couple things to share, but I'll let you do it. I'm here if you need me. Take it away, friend.
Okay. Well, I'm going to use this opportunity to outline my nursery seed career in one go, which I've never done before. So this is a so this is really good for me to recap, not only for yous, but for other people in my circuit. I'll be able to explain and then build on this. So this is the beginner. So I started organic farming in 1972, and as I said, in 1978 I was inspired to start Friends of the Tree Society. So in that year I started my first tree sale and I started a seed service. So I started, in a sense, two businesses. And here's how, and what I'm going to hope that you'll get out of my talk is some ideas for nursery niches and how to do it low cost. Because I was a very poor person in those days, considered to be. And so I did my first tree sale with, I didn't even have a car. I didn't have land. I didn't grow. All I did was buy a bunch of trees from Lawyer Nursery, trees and shrubs that I knew were good quality, what things people should be growing, and I brought it to my local co-op one day with advertising ahead and said, "Come to the tree sale. I'll have all the trees there, and you can buy them from me and take them home and plant them." And it was successful. And I built on that over the years. And over the next 6 years or so, I started putting out a mail order pre-order thing. It would all come in the mail. It was all mail those days. So I would get the orders in the mail. I would pre-package them after I got the plants. I started buying from additional nurseries. And I started going to multiple towns. And so I probably built up to maybe going to six different small towns in Eastern Washington to sell the trees, just single day stands and what they now call pop-up shops. That's a new word for me, but I had a pop-up shop starting in 78, and at our height, I linked up with Bear Creek Nursery, which was a famous, one of the most famous permaculture nurseries in North America at that time. This would have been in the late 80s and into the 90s, where I was working with Bear Creek Nursery. And Larry and Barbagino, they took over a bunch of towns. I kept a bunch of those towns, and we had a guy in Idaho that took a bunch of towns, and we had a tree sale in 24 cities in 1 year, or towns and localities, 24, with three different teams, two people on a team, and we distributed huge amounts of plants. And so we built up. So that's one idea, is to have a traveling tree sale. And then after a while, that was a lot of work. I turned them also into public plant and seed exchanges. So I would bring my tree sale, traveling tree sale, but at the same time there would be a local public plant and seed exchange, and a whole lot of other people would bring things. And that really made the whole thing more successful because it brought a little more people in, more action, more plants. And so they were really these public ones were really fun. I highly encouraged that. And you can sell your stuff there. And then in 1990, I upped the game again, and I put on a two events back to back, the Bellingham Tree Jamboree and the Port, oh no, Tree Extravaganza and the Port Townsend Tree Extravaganza. And I had big turnouts at both of them. We had 1,000 people in Port Townsend, so it became a tree festival. So it was called the Tree Extravaganza at first, but it was, after a couple of years, it became the Port Townsend Tree Festival and lasted for 20 years. But in that first year there, we had 30, 10 nurseries. We had all the environmental groups and conservation groups and ag agencies and the Forest Service all had their booths there to reach the general public. And we sold 30, I sold $30,000 worth of nursery stock in one go, in one day. And that was really, that was a mag one of my most magnificent moments. We had three or four cashiers going at one time and six people filling orders, and we cranked. And that was a $30,000 of trees out in one day is doing really, we were seriously clicking along. The Bellingham Tree Extravaganza is still going on today. They changed the name. It's just the Fairhaven Nursery Sale or something like that, but it's never stopped. All the way from 1990. So I feel good about that. So you can hopefully in your life maybe start a tree festival or a tree sale or some tree event in your area that will carry on over the years. But even 1 year is good. So don't be afraid. Even 1 year is a good thing to do. Okay, since then, so that was 1990. And then since that period of time, I've done tree sales off and on. There's been periods in my life where I didn't do tree sales. I still conducted the seed business morph over the years. At first, I sold tree and shrub seeds primarily. I sold because I was friends of the trees. And so I had seed racks in something like seven different co-ops in our area. Mainly trees and shrub seed, and with a information on how to propagate or how to get them to germinate, which is sometimes difficult for trees and some trees and shrubs. So over the years, at I At one point I was doing a lot of garden plants. I hooked up with a woman who was a wonderful homesteader, and between us we were two green thumbs, and we produced a lot of seed just from the garden. And now I'll talk about now in a few in a I do well, let me I guess I'll go to now. Okay, so the current situation is that 25 years ago I started farming medicinal herbs commercially. So actually in 1996 was my first year wildcrafting and selling wildcrafted botanicals. Over time, also did farmed botanicals. And as a result of having the farm, pretty soon you have a good seed production. So I've been, as a seeds person, whenever I put in a permaculture planting in year one, there is seed production because the annual plants produce seed, and I grow some for that. And then the second year, you get a bit more, you get the biennials, a lot of time will be seeding. And then after that, the perennials will start seeding. And there's a thing called by Bill Mollis, and there's an article, you could probably find it online, called Phases of Abundance. It's a really good article. I read it a long time ago, sort of a classic, not a long article, a couple of pages. And he talks about the different phases of abundance in a permaculture system. And year three, four is when the phases of abundance of nursery propagation material really take off. And so as a result, 3 or 4 years in, 5 or 6, the longer the time, of course, the higher percentage of things go into seeding. But you can really have a lot of seed. You can start in the first year, but usually by year 3 or 4, you're really having significant seed production of my perennial herbs, and that's my main seed crops these days. So right now our seed offering is around 80 species. Most of them are medicinal plants, and we sell by the ounce, mostly your quarter ounce to an ounce, and sometimes all the way up to a pound. But it's pounds of seed. Sometimes it takes a lot of seeds to make a pound. Any rate, so what else would I say about what we're doing now? I have a little, maybe I'll show a bit of the my few slides here. I'll do a little screen sharing. And it should be more about the now. But any questions about that past stuff or any of those particular, just right now, we could actually say from that last riff, is there any questions that came up for people? How did I do that or
As a
whatever?
matter of fact, one did. What is your advice for advertising for pop-up events? Are there certain groups or locations you found to be the most profitable for sales?
Well, the I would say that posters was the main way that I did it. Word of mouth was also very big, maybe even bigger. Having hand flyers that people just passed around to their friends. I could leave 10 with a friend in one area, and he would pass them out gradually, or post them. And I also found that going to all the other organizations locally, like if there's a conservation district, or if there's the county extension even, or conservation groups, anybody that was involved, the garden clubs, anything that's happening in your area to do with plants, a lot of times they'll tell their members, or you build relations with them so that you become one of the members is ideal. And then you can spread the word through the other networks that plant networks that exist. Those would be the, and nowadays, of course, you have the internet, and I would definitely have Facebook event pages and that sort of thing. But I guess, and then getting it in the local newspaper for a couple of weeks ahead of time, I guess I would say you got to hit it on as many layers as possible if you really want to succeed these days.
The cooperative grocery stores would be another one to add. Jeffrey asked, the day you sold 30,000, did you have all those trees on hand or did you deliver some of them at a later date?
They were all on hand, and maybe about 50% were pre-ordered. So we already had them pre-packaged with their name on it, and all they had to do was, what I always recommend is that you open that bundle, check it off against the list and make sure that you got everything in there in case we goofed up. And then they and so that went pretty quick. And then the other half, or $15,000 worth of trees, they were in stock in bins with sawdust primarily, and right there in at hand. And so we could just zip around and grab three of this and two of that and one of that and put it in a bag and get it ready for that customer.
Perfect. Yeah, that's kind of like Greg Peterson's model that he's been doing too. Like pop-up nursery, and you sell the materials and you have extra for people who didn't pre-sell. So yeah, thank you. Jeff says thank you. That's great. So that's all the questions for now. So maybe we want to go to some slides, or were you going to show the
Okay, all
Instagram
right.
clip?
Let's see if I can get do a share here, and it says I'll say share
Yep, I'm
down
seeing that.
here, and then I need to go to my PowerPoint here, and I'll need to make it s view by slideshow.
Yep.
Da da da. Can you
Perfect.
see that then, or
Yep,
is it
that looks
partly
good.
cut off?
Nope, looks good.
Okay, so here's a couple of nurseries I'm going to recommend for people that want to buy in plant material. And unfortunately, some of them are only for more or less in the Northwest. But at any rate, many of the nurseries I used to buy from are out of business now. It's sad, especially Lawyer Nursery. It's so sad that you don't have that opportunity. However, at any rate.
Yes, I'm just going to second that, Skeeter. Lawyer Nursery was like where I got all my bulk sale plants that I would sell within my community. So it's sad
Yeah,
they're gone.
exactly. I used to buy thousands of dollars, or tens of thousands, even some years, from them. So now I'm getting what I can from Clifty View Nursery. Now they're kind of like lawyers. Actually, they're better than lawyers. So what I say about Clifty View is that they sell, depending on what size you buy, but if you can get some really nice, robust stock, especially at the larger sizes. And I can't think of anything I've ever received from Clifty View that wasn't good. I mean, that where some things look like they were dying or whatever. I certainly get that with Lawyer. He had a little percentage. He had a 5% stiff rate maybe. But Clifty View has good quality stuff. It's mainly seedling conservation plants. Some choke cherries and aronias and some food plants, and a lot of conifers, which I don't use as much. But at any rate, that you buy them by the 50 or 100. The 100 price break is where I almost always bought my plants, because as soon as you get to the 100, the price is less than 50 and less than 10 if you can even get them. Most of the company things I places I buy from, you have to buy 100, 50 or 100 minimum anyway. So go for the 100 rate if you can, but 50 rate. Okay, the second one here is the Washington Conservation District Nursery called Plant Materials Center. It's in Bow, Washington, and they produce a wide variety of, again, conservation plants, and some of them are edible plants. A fair amount of them fit into permaculture, and the price is right. They have good prices for what they offer. And that you get a nice bare root stock, and you have to buy $500 minimum. So some of these bigger ones here, you can't just say, "Oh, I want two of those and three of those and one of those." You have to buy in bulk. Another one here is Fourth Corner Nursery, and they are one of the largest native plant nurseries on the West Coast, and they have a really wide The biggest diversity of native plants I know of in our local industry, and it's decent quality. And you have to, a lot of time, some things are only available in small sizes, but they have a lot of material if you're in the Northwest. If you're not in the Northwest, you might buy some things from them anyway, but it's pretty much all native plants. So those are three of the places I buy plants from currently. So moving on. We do a lot of plant division. So at our farm, our herb farm right now, there's a we every year we dig a lot of marshmallow root for sale for the botanical business. And we take part of that material and we make propagation material out of it. So we take the crowns, we cut off all the big roots and the arms and legs, as I call them, and then I cut the crown up into nice little crown cuttings and sell those. So selling crown divisions and rhizomes is a really big part of our current business. So that's our nursery business, is and specializes in selling starts of medicinal plants. And so this is black cohosh here. These are just plants that haven't been divided yet. These are just the chunky. I can see the roots. The small roots have already been cut off. They'll go into the product, and these are the chunkier crowns in which I will need to divide up. Here's a some of
Hey,
my sorts
Skeeter,
aren't the best. Yeah.
I hear the pen, your pen is a going again.
Okay, good catch.
Sorry to be annoying.
Yeah, well, I don't want to be annoying. So anyway, here's black cohosh, smaller propagation material. This is maybe not my typical propagation material, but this is close enough. It has good healthy buds on it, a lot of roots. We usually don't wash it this good. This is probably actually was set up maybe more for sale, but we leave a bit of dirt on them as well. So there's just a division idea. And here is our just part of the front poster here. I just put this together last night, and I didn't have my office, my staff that could help me make these look good. But anyway, it gives you an idea. The 2025 schedule, we're just doing two pop-up shops this year, Chimicum, our main sale, and Twispin, Eastern Washington. So you can see here, I'm holding a bundle of the red osier dogwood there. That's kind of like standard for a lot of our bare root stock. It's that those aren't Some things are smaller than that, some things are larger, but oftentimes that's about the kind of scale that I buy. Big enough that they'll be almost for sure going to succeed, but small enough that they're not too pricey. So I tend to buy not at the top of the size range, but near the top these days, because people do want bigger plants. So I tend to err more. It's easier to sell a bigger plant, big plant, than a little, really tiny one, especially when the customers are looking at it. So the nice thing about bare root is that you can cram an awful lot of them in a small place. I could say this. I feel sorry for all those people that have nurseries of 1 gallon pots and 2 gallon pots and things, because it takes, you can only squeeze so many in a truckload. Whereas with, I can put thousands and thousands of bare roots on a truck. So on the bare root, I would say an important thing is not to let them dry out, or unduly. Sometimes if they're at a pop-up shop, a lot of times you need them displayed. So you'll see maybe in a YouTube here, I put a lot of my stock at the sale itself is in a 5 gallon bucket full of water, and there might be a couple of things to a bucket or sometimes, but the keep the roots totally moist while they're being on display and easier to extract for the customer. Another thing is that you have to keep them dry in between your events or when your sales, usually I get trees in one, let's say in at the end of March, let's say, and that I have them held up for up to 2 months. I keep them in stock, either in a cold storage if I have it, or as cold a spot as I can get. And I learned something really early before I had cold storages, that if I had a lot of this bare root stock and I had to hold it for maybe even weeks and weeks, I would throw them in the pond. We had a really cold pond that was really cold temperature, always came out at 42 degrees from a spring. So I would just toss these bundles in there and make sure all the roots were totally submerged, tops and bottoms just totally immersed in the pond. And then weeks later, I could fish them out and they'd be perfectly good. They stayed cold, they stayed hydrated. I mean, I'm sure you could leave them in too long, but I think I'm sure I've left them in up to a month. That doesn't work for conifers, folks. That's for deciduous bare root. Any rate, just a little trick there. Oops, I'm going to go back here. You wonder what that colorful plant there is on the left. That is madder. That's madder shoots. They're probably just below the soil surface. Look at that kaleidoscope of colors. But they're primarily a red dye. So they're a dye plant and a medicinal, but most of the it's we have never figured out how to market this really good. But if somebody had a good fiber, I need a fiber seeds, fiber crop store. But at any rate, there's madder. And here's a list of our what we're selling this year. So you can see that we're not really big. You can see there's like maybe 25 trees and shrubs. There's maybe 20 herb rhizomes and maybe 20 crown divisions and some herb seedlings. These are all bare root. And I'm going to get a little bit more close up here. So one of our markets is for people that want to start a new herb farm or a big herb garden, and they want to get a bunch of herb starts. And you can buy all the seeds, start them in a greenhouse, pot them up to a 4-inch pot, and then finally plant them in the ground. Or you could save yourself all that trouble and just buy the bare root plants from me. Just pop them in the ground. They're usually big, robust, and will grow right away and fast and big and less hassle. So we're and so we I always prided myself on being one of the lowest priced nurseries. I always like to pride myself. I have the lowest priced permaculture courses some years in the past. I like having lower priced events. I like catering to poor people. But over the years, the demands of business and expenses has meant that our prices have just kept creeping up. And but you can see a lot of times our herbs right now, our perennial crown divisions are $4, $5, $6 each is the general rule. But if anybody's interested in, so this is our niche, selling to people that want to start herb gardens, herb farms, and we ship this. So this is a ship situation. But we have our main pop-up plant sale. This is horrible photo, but there's the crew, and in the background you can see, we got some Costco canopy tents up here. And here I'm about to do a. This is a frontispiece. If we can show you, this is a 3-minute video cover, but you can see in the back there. There's a whole lot of cardboard boxes with signs on them, and each one of those boxes has a different kind of herb propagation material. And so we may have 40, 50, because we sell more here than we do online, because we have little specialty items and stuff. So, at any rate, they're all lined up there alphabetically so that the customer can find them easily, so our packing team can find things easily. And in front of me, you can't really see, but there's a bunch of those 5-gallon buckets with the trees in. So that's about, how much kind of our footprint for our, or part of our footprint for our current event. And this is just a couple, again, horrible shots, but this is just a couple of shots of the farm. That's my son Ashley on the right here, and Ashley's taking over the farm, so we're a father-son business, a few part-time employees, like Rebecca there, and we produce around $50,000 worth of product on a quarter acre, where we've added a bit of ground now. So that's $200,000 a year per acre if we had a whole acre in this kind of thing. So I like to impress people with that. Look. 50,000 gross on a quarter acre is pretty good. 200,000 on an acre, you say, well, I might be able to start making a living on a pretty small footprint. But to do that, we have high value. We sell a lot of 100 species of crops out of it. There's a lot of medicinal plants that we sell. That's our main bread and butter is fresh herbs. Next bread and butter is dried herbs. Propagation material is more of a not the big seller, but it adds up. And then seeds themselves. So we have four main yields from the place, plus a little bit of education. And so, there's the future, folks. Get yourself a nursery. Maybe your kids will actually even help you over time. But let's be under the rainbow. And rainbows happen in everybody's lives. There's also thunderstorms and violent tornadoes. Every life has big upsets, and it has those really under the rainbow times. So, wishing that all of you experience a lot of good rainbow times coming up. Oops. And I also, again, what time is it? How are we doing? Oh, we're actually, I guess, getting too late probably to show YouTubes, but I have a 25-year-old medicinal agroforestry system. Go and look at it online. And finally, I not only have a lot of practical experience, I do a lot with books and have book sales and have a big library. And so it's good to study, but more important is the experiential hands-on learning. And I've put out various books over the years and publications. You can find a lot of my writings on friendsofthetrees.net. That's where most of my writings are. So maybe I'll see you there and somewhere in some of the articles. So I'm going to, that's the stop share point.
Yeah,
Are we back?
that's so good. Thank you so much. Did you want to try to do the Instagram video, or is it
Oh,
maybe?
I think we'll pass on that because of the timing. I did
Okay.
have maybe a few other practical things to talk about, but I knew you wanted to have time for questions and answers, so we're going till the hour, is that right?
Yeah, but up to about 5 to the hour. And just so folks know, the PCX area where this whole summit is happening, the feed space, that's going to start to get filled after today and after we can start to harvest some of the resources. And some of those resources for sure will be Skeeter's videos. He has an amazing collection of videos about how to start like a food forestry system and get yields from it, kind of like you were saying, the phases of abundance, like Bill Mollison's thing. Skeeter does it better than anybody I know, getting annual production, then biennial, and then having your trees come in for years to come into the future. So we'll be putting a lot of those videos into the PCX later so people can check those out. But hey, it sounded like you said you had a couple practical things to add. Let's do that real quick. And then if anybody has questions for Skeeter, put them in the chat and we'll get to those.
Okay, I just wanted to mention several other nursery items. Ken Asmus, he does a lot of grafted fruit trees, certain seedlings. I was amazed that I can't wait to go look at the Oikos catalog again. But we mainly, as I said, do herbaceous propagation. We do a fair amount of production from hardwood cuttings. I just took a bunch of cuttings yesterday. It's easy to grow gooseberries and currants and willows and populace and things. There's certain things that are really easy, and so I just really recommend that as a way to grow a lot of plants really easily. Hardwood cuttings is one of the easiest. And then when it gets to grafting trees, I remember at Bear Creek Nursery, who was, like I said, the most famous permaculture nursery, or one of them at the time, he sold bench grafted fruit trees. In other words, we would buy, again, from Lawyer Nursery, bundles of 100 rootstocks, apple rootstocks, nice healthy apple rootstocks, about the size of maybe small, about the size of my pen kind of diameter. And then we would graft on scion wood and, tie it securely. And then we would package that up delicately and ship those. And they arrived at people's doorstep. They planted them, and they, plant grew, and the scion grew, and they had a fruit tree for only $5 instead of or these days it might be only $10 instead of 25, $30, and it's cheaper on the shipping as well. So anyway, that's just a little. I've never seen it not being offered too much. We also sell hardwood cuttings. You can also sell hardwood cuttings as another little angle. And when it comes to grafting, that's such a great skill to have. And I have done some grafting in my life, but I've never really excelled in it. But my son actually was trained when he was a teenager how to graft. And for about 10 years, that was a major source of income. And he could do thousands of grafts a day, thousands of buds, and there were sometimes top working. But he did a lot of that fruit tree top working as well. You cut a big branch off and you put in, six side bark or 10 side bark grafts into that one stump. So anyway, so my son really excelled in the grafting, and so that's a great skill to have, and it of course opens up a lot of different marketing opportunities. And I remember my son recently. He grows a certain amount of 4-inch pots and sells at our local nursery down the road. We sell it to him wholesale, and it helps bring in some money. And he was also doing 1 gallon pots, trees, shrubs, herbs, 1 gallon pots. And after a couple of years of doing that, he said, I'm really tailing back on that because for the amount of effort, he didn't feel it was really paying for his time. So it may be a sign that potted stock is a harder way to make a living. But people can make it all work. It depends on your market. Okay, that was just a couple. Maybe I'll just say another word. It's called liners. So in the nursery industry, when you buy really small stock of something, let's say 3 inches high or 6 inches high, depends on the species. And they're called liners. You buy them 100 at a time, and they're really cheap because they're small. What you can, it's hard to, you can sell them. You can also put them in a 1 gallon pot, and then a year later, they have something really sizable. Or you can just plant them out yourself in a row and grow them out for another 1 or 2 years till they get good sized, and then sell them at the bigger size. So buying liners is one of the ways to sort of get a rootstock or a start without as much money. Okay, that was my
Yeah.
couple other tips.
Those are really good tips. Thank you. Some of those had not been shared yet in the summit, so appreciate it. Had a question from Ryan. What is your preferred medium for rooting cuttings?
I tried a lot of different things. Mostly we put them directly in the ground, but here's a sequence of events that we tend to do, not always. Take the cuttings, put them in a wooden box, end down, and then a lot of moist chips or potting soil or something that really is absorbent. And I would hold them maybe in a root cellar or even in a cold storage for a month if I needed to. And then I would we would actually take them out and put them in buckets of water and put in a bunch of willow cuttings. So cut up some willow stems and throw it in there as a sort of a natural a rooting hormone, and leave them in there for weeks, 2 weeks or a month, and then at that point pull them out and plant them. So all right, my ideal way is that when I pull them out of that bucket, they're putting out little roots already. They're just starting. There's a You can see some roots actually trailing out, but there's a lot of little tiny root knobs there. You can see, oh, those are about to pop. That's a great time to put it in the ground. And you don't want to shove it in there into a hard ground and strip all that tender growth away. So you got to make your hole and then put it in safely and then pack it in nicely. And that's, but I also, saying that, another way I do it is in a 1 gallon pot, I'll put 2 or even 4 cuttings in a 1 gallon pot or maybe a 2 gallon pot, and I could put in 5 or 6, or it varies depending on the vigor of the plant. And get them, once they start into growth, they got some leaves and they have really good solid roots, I just upend the pot and then plant those out. And 'cause sometimes when you plant things out as straight as a just as the cutting itself, sometimes things can go wrong, some can dry out or whatever, you can lose some. Whereas if you have a plant that's start it rooted and partly leafed out, if you handle it delicately, that plant's just going to continue to grow really fast. And so you can get a bunch of things started safely in a small space and then plant out. So there's a couple tricks.
Yeah, I love it. Hey, I don't see any other questions, so this gives me a chance to just can you briefly explain your concept of medicinal forests? That's something we've been kicking around, and I know you've been wanting to sort of promote that idea.
Yeah, I want to do a webinar sometime, hopefully soon, on medicinal forests, and I have a 25-year-old medicinal forest that I produce that I put in myself, and it was abandoned for some years, and so it shows what a permaculture system can look like after abandonment, which is really a cool experiment. We More of you should abandon your plantings, or at least I've abandoned a number of mine over the years because I moved. So, but anyway, the concept is that we have an overstory trees, understory shrubs, and ground story, and then herbaceous perennials, and then creeping ground covers and vines. The usual seven, you could say, seven stories, and then roots in the ground. Seven different stories of layers of plants, and then they're all medicinal. I mean, it's hard to make a system that's 100% medicinal. It's certainly possible. It's not that hard. It's just that there's always weeds that want to, and other things that want to pop in that may not necessarily fit your idea. So, at any rate, you can, if you establish it and take really good care of it, and especially if you mulch it good, keep it, after a few years, it starts taking care of itself and planting itself and mulching itself and becomes relatively bulletproof. But it takes time. You have to really put your time in to really keep it weeded and tended and watered, and what if it needs it, that you really baby. You have to babysit it for some years, and then it's just like a teenager. They want less and less of you, and then at a certain point, they just want to make their own decisions. So that's, in a sense, we could say maybe there's the different periods of a lifetime of a medicinal forest. And just like a baby child, we have to really tend it carefully, and it takes a lot of doting over in the first couple of years. Generally, though, I guess there's people that have managed to do it with that what they call sheer utter total neglect. But I tend to babysit my new plantings fairly assiduously. Anyway, that's a little bit on that.
Yeah, I would like to double tap on and go more into that at some point with you. I think that's a great idea. One question, and then we'll probably break. Kelda asks, can you talk about selling herbs wholesale, and if you need to test and document that what you're harvesting for specific species?
Well, those are, I could spend an hour or a day on each of those questions there, Kelda, but it's lovely to see your smiling face. Market share is tough. It's kind of like Ken said about the nursery industry. There's not that many herb farms out there, but there's only so many customers, though they're making new ones every year. We have our stable tried and true customers that are our bread and butter, and then every year new customers show up that are starting a new business, and some of them have become really successful really quickly and are now really good sized buyers. So I guess reaching out to the current established markets out there, and which is kind of hard because most of those buyers don't switch at the drop of a hat. For instance, you might say, oh, I'll beat their price. I'll beat their price. I'll beat everybody's price. You can be like Walmart. We're the cheapest. Come to us. Well, sometimes they'll be suspicious that you're actually going to give them good stuff with that tactic. But the current buyers, if they're getting good stuff from somebody that they know and they've done it for years, they're not likely to want to switch horses in the middle of the stream. If I go out of business, then they're going to be looking for somebody to fill those niches. Making local connections, a local herb CSAs, oh, darn it. I think at some point local herbal CSAs might work depending on the locality. probably big cities. So talk to me more, Calda. I can send you bits. I can send you multiple literature. So you remind me if I don't, okay?
Well, and also maybe you want to just touch on testing. Do you have to do a lot of testing to make sure that, you're harvesting the right species and that it's like accurate and that sort of thing?
No,
Okay.
we just, I know all my plants, and I have made a mistake a couple of times in my life that I've made mistakes, but they're super rare, and so what did Selena Heron said about me one time? She said, "Oh, of all my wild crafters that I've had, Michael Blarsky is the only one that's never sent me the wrong thing."
Wow, that's a good
So
compliment.
I like that anecdote, but yeah, happy to talk more, Kelda. And I have a lot of information on my, as Jesse said, on my YouTube channels, and also my Friends of the Trees Botanicals website. So you should go to friendsofthetreesbotanicals.com and go to my friendsofthetrees.net. And if you want to know the international scene, then you should go to Global Earth Repair Foundation.org. So maybe there's some way for Jesse to pass on the various contacts I have.
Yeah,
Okay.
absolutely. We'll make sure that that happens. Well, Skeeter, thank you so much. This has been amazing. Your wisdom is like shining through. Clearly, you've been doing this for a long time and you have a lot of wisdom to share about it. I hope you keep going for another 47 years. And we'll see you in the round table in about a half an hour, everybody. Thanks for being here. Thanks again, Michael. Appreciate you.
Okay. I'm going to do a video sometime of all my mistakes.
Oh,
Yeah,
that'd be
just
a
set
good
the
one.
record straight. Yeah. Those are fun.
To be continued. Bye-bye, everybody.